We're going to start off with the second session talking about Lyme disease, borreliosis. And then we'll talk a little bit about Bartonellosis, which is, if you're not very familiar with canine Bartonellosis, it's kind of making a big splash around the tick-transmitted disease world. So I hopefully I'll be able to present some information to you that might be useful for you in practice when you're dealing with some of these dogs. And if we have time later, I have a little case that we'll go over as well. So Lyme disease, unlike the previous session, we were talking about organisms that are intracellular. Lyme or borreliosis, Borrelia burgdorferi, is not an intracellular organism. It's a spirochete that is tick-transmitted, but it actually is extracellular. Even though it's an extracellular agent, it can't survive outside of the host or the tick. So it must be transmitted by the tick. So person to person, dog to dog, dog to person has not been documented with this infectious agent. You will not find the organism in the patient. It's very difficult to find these bugs. One is that they're very low numbers, and two, you have to either have dark field microscopy or some other mechanisms, phase contrast mechanisms, to actually see the bug. So really finding the organism and identifying it is not a good way to try to diagnose this disease. This is, again, a map of canine seropositive Lyme results, just showing the different prevalences in different states in the country. And so you can kind of pick out your state and see how you're doing with regard to Lyme disease. As I mentioned before, if you were here the first hour, when I first got to Florida, we didn't have Lyme disease. In fact, you know, we used to always think that it didn't really even exist as a disease at all. But now we have lots of it in different areas of the state. It's transmitted by the same ticks that transmit anaplasma. And I talked to many of you over the break and heard some questions from you during the last session where you're in areas where Lyme and anaplasma exist and you're dealing with co-infections with these diseases. And certainly they're transmitted by the tick, same tick vector, so they're in the same areas. If you look, and this is true of all the tick-borne diseases, and I had another question about this at the break as well. How long does it take an attached tick to transmit the disease? I don't know the answer to that. If you look at the studies that actually looked at tick bite sites for infection, and this was actually done with Ehrlichia, and evaluated how long, they say it took a minimum of 24 hours of tick attachment to transmit the disease. But I don't know whether that's really true or not in natural conditions, you know, how this organism works. Because certainly, talking with people, they seem to think that they've contracted Lyme disease by tick bites there where the tick they know didn't spend more than a few hours on them. So I don't know exactly how long it takes. But technically, it's supposed to take 24 hours a minimum tick attachment. So let's talk about clinical Lyme disease and what we know about it. Well, one of the things that we recognize with this disease is that it actually has a low morbidity. Although many animals in endemic areas seem to be positive for Lyme disease and are probably infected with it and never actually develop clinical signs associated with the disease. And we talked about the primary clinical finding of lameness and fever. Some animals have lymphadenopathy and anorexia. And in the acute phase of the disease, what we recognize is that most animals will spontaneously get better. And if you look at experimental tick inoculation of dogs with Borrelia, what Staubinger found is that 75% of the animals in his study developed clinical signs of Lyme disease after tick inoculation. It took 60 days, and some of you who practice in endemic areas probably note that when tick season starts, that might be when you see your anaplasma cases, but it's after that that you start seeing your Lyme cases because it's got a long incubation period. So 60 days after, 75% of his dogs developed clinical signs of polyarthritis, but it was mild and it only lasted a few days and then went away. So then what happens with these dogs? They're subclinically infected at that point. And some animals, we know, develop chronic borreliosis, just like the other diseases we were talking about. Which ones? Who knows? And when we find these animals that develop chronic disease, we know they're a problem to deal with. Chronic polyarthritis, especially this chronic glomerulonephritis, and those animals usually don't survive once they develop protein-losing glomerulonephropathies. And then we can also get heart disease and sometimes neurological disease. But I think the more common findings are the animals with polyarthritis and protein-losing glomerulonephritis. If you catch them and they're in clinically with polyarthritis, you will find in their joints predominantly a neutrophilic inflammatory response. However, unlike anaplasma, you won't find the organisms in these animals' joints. Okay, you virtually never see that. So we just kind of have to look at these animals clinically and evaluate them serologically. Yes, sir?
Would you find the organism in the injection site sometime after the time of injection?
The question is, can you actually find the organism at the tick bite site? Yes, you could if you did the proper microscopy to identify it. Yeah, you could find it there at the tick bite site. If you did phase contrast or dark field microscopy, what happens is that once they're inoculated, they'll migrate through the tissues, and they'll usually head for a joint space. Don't know how they find them, but they do. And they maybe sniff them out, and they'll go to a joint space, and then they infect a single joint and then spread from there to other joints. Interestingly, for years, we thought that, unlike the other tick-borne diseases, really we found no hematologic abnormalities associated with Lyme infection, and that the only serum biochemical abnormalities might be associated with animals that develop protein-losing glomerulonephropathies. However, there was a study, and we'll talk a little bit more about this in just a few minutes, where Labradors and Golden Retrievers that were Lyme positive had thrombocytopenias that was felt to be associated with Lyme disease. And again, I'll talk a little bit more about that with the breed susceptibilities. And some of you who practice in this area may find that Golden Retrievers and Labrador Retrievers tend to develop chronic Lyme disease and more severe Lyme disease, and we'll tell you what some of the work that's been done with that. So this is what was done out of the University of Pennsylvania, and they looked at a couple of groups of dogs, and this was done evaluating them with the SNAP 3DX assay. Of their healthy donor animals, they found 24% positive for Lyme. Of animals that were tested for, as they came into the hospital for a number of different reasons, in sick animals, 35% of them were Lyme positive at the University of Penn. So then they looked at this population of animals and pulled out these breeds because they were overrepresented in the population. And what they found was that with regard to animals presenting with lameness from these breeds, 50% of the labs that presented with lameness were Lyme positive, as compared, of course, to the 35% general population being Lyme positive. Goldens, 70% of the golden retrievers that were lame were also Lyme positive. And German Shepherds, only 33, kind of matching more what the general population would be. So that was pretty interesting. What was even more interesting is the protein-losing glomerulonephropathies, how many of these animals, particularly the golden retrievers, were positive for Lyme disease, 96% of them. And no German Shepherds with thrombocytopenia, but 44% of the labs with thrombocytopenia and 71% of the golden retrievers were Lyme positive. So it kind of adds a little bit of credence to the increased susceptibility of these animals to developing chronic borreliosis. And for a while, you know, for a long time, it's just empirically, we felt like there's a lot of these animals developing severe Lyme disease, but maybe it's just because there's so many of them. But this kind of sheds a little bit light on it, that there may be an increased susceptibility, particularly with the glomerulonephritis and golden retrievers. So how about diagnosing Lyme disease? So we had a lot of different assays being developed over the years in human and veterinary medicine. And the bottom line was that to really, because of vaccination and cross-reactivity, IFAs and ELISAs were not very good for diagnosing Lyme disease. So Western Immunoblot, which is a pretty sophisticated analysis, was really developed to kind of distinguish animals that and people that were really infected with Lyme and those that were not. And so then the SNAP3DX assay was developed, and people started comparing it to the Western Immunoblot. The bottom line is that of all the diagnostic assays, quick rapid assays, this one's probably the best designed assay of any of the diagnostic tests that I'm familiar with. And it compared favorably with the Western Immunoblot assay, so that now it's pretty, this particular study that was in J. Clin Microbiology actually stated that the C6 ELISA for Lyme disease, if you use that, you don't need to run Western Immunoblots in these patients. It was really equivalent to running immunoblot assays. So it's a very good diagnostic assay, and I want to explain to you a little bit about what we know about this test. Much of this you're probably already aware of. This C6 peptide is a peptide that is in the organism that is not exposed to the animal's immune system unless the organism is viable and proliferates. A dead, killed organism does not expose the C6 peptide. Okay, so it's only exposed to the immune system if the organism is alive. All right, so that's one thing. It was shown to detect antibodies in 30% of the cases at 3 weeks, and 1 to 2 weeks later, 100% of the cases in experimental infection. So well before the incubation period is up, these animals are showing positive reaction on the SNAP3DX test. And I did not do this particular work, but it showed a 94% sensitivity and 99.7% specificity, really high specificity. And again, this indicates the accuracy and the lack of false positives, okay? And this would be false negatives. So lack of false negatives, lack of false positives associated with this particular assay. Because it does not expose itself to the immune system in a killed organism, animals vaccinated with Lyme disease with any one of these vaccines, and they were vaccinated at 0, 2, 33, 36, and 39 weeks, never developed antibodies to C6. Okay, so vaccinated animals won't develop antibodies. And this is some work done by Steve Levy in Connecticut, who actually published in Vet Therapeutics, looking at the effectiveness of different vaccines, and I don't know which vaccines. You'd have to pull this article to actually get detailed. The bottom line overall was that of the unvaccinated animals, he had about a 60% positive reaction, and in the vaccinated animals, 5%. Now, if you're interested in what vaccines he was using the results, you know, you can pull this article out of Vet Therapeutics and take a look at that, because I'm not really familiar. I don't remember which of these vaccines were actually evaluated. But it did show that the vaccines were effective in preventing the disease or in presenting infection in many cases. So what's the current recommended treatment? Currently, doxycycline is used as a first-line drug, at the high doses for 30 days. These other drugs that we mentioned here, azithromycin and ceftriaxone, have been used in cases, in human cases, and in some animal cases that are refractory to doxycycline and at these doses. Relatively expensive drugs to use, so definitely doxycycline, first line of treatment for these animals. With these infectious diseases, I didn't talk much about it before, we try to avoid using corticosteroids, and we mentioned about the immune complex disease. It may not be possible in all cases for you to resolve all clinical signs of the animals without using glucocorticoids. If you do elect to use them, you should have the animal on my antimicrobials first and give that a chance. Give that animal a week or more of antimicrobials to see if you're going to get a response. If you don't and you need to use glucocorticoids, use them at anti-inflammatory doses, not immunosuppressive doses. We don't like to use that on these infectious agents because in some cases it can make the animals worse. So be careful if you have to use them. This, I thought, was pretty interesting, and I asked Dr. Eberts if I could use this information about what he found in his practice. He's a practitioner in Baxter, Minnesota, and I've done some work with him actually. In fact, he allowed me to, he helped me collect Stabilate from infected dogs that we then utilized in our experimental trials. And by the way, he collected from 8 dogs, and three of those dogs were co-infected, and I could not use them because we ran a battery of PCR tests on these blood samples to make sure that, and serology to make sure that they weren't co-infected before I inoculated the animals with it. 3 of them were co-infected with Bartonella, and we're going to talk a little bit about Bartonella and what the problems that it creates. Anyway, what he did when the SNAP test first came out, and it's really, you know, and that's why I'm recommending for those of you who are working with the 4DX to kind of think about this, is that he followed his cases that were Lyme positive for a year because he wasn't sure what to do with these animals that were clinically healthy and testing positive for Lyme. And 25% of them developed clinical polyarthritis that was responsive to doxycycline within a year's period. Now, he also has anaplasma, and this was not, he wasn't testing these animals for it. However, he does treat them now, which I'm understanding that many of you have been doing when they're positive, and it's rare for him to get an animal that's positive, for him to put them on treatment, and then for them later to develop signs, when 25% of them actually developed it the first year that he was diagnosed. And he practices in an area that has approximately 40 plus or minus 10% positivity of animals coming through his door for Lyme disease. But that's not unusual if you're in an endemic area in a hot spot of it. That is not an unusual number. So imagine he has a lot of doxycycline that he goes through during the season. Okay, before we get to Bartonella, if anyone has any questions about Lyme disease, I certainly would want to try to answer them or even open them up to the floor because sometimes I like to get help. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't come out and directly say it, did I? Yeah, and I wasn't trying to be a politician on that either. I believe that you should treat these animals that are positive for Lyme disease. I honestly think that there is a benefit to treating them. And this is a little different than what I said with the anaplasma, but the reason is we know that the C6 peptide will be positive in animals if they have been exposed to viable organisms, not from vaccination, not cross-reactivity. And we also know that Lyme disease, unlike anaplasma, where we're uncertain, causes chronic infection and clinical disease. And we don't know how many animals will get it, but certainly a percentage, and at least in Matt's case, 25% of his dogs within a year develop clinical disease. So I think those are good reasons to treat those animals. Uh-huh. The question was if you find animals that have low titers, that they're probably at an early stage of infection, and there might be disadvantage to treating them at the early stage. In everything that I have seen in the literature, just the opposite is true, that the time that you want to catch animals and treat them is in the acute stage of the disease and not once they've developed chronic borreliosis. Those animals are the ones that you have the difficult time in treating the infection and clearing. I have not heard that. I don't know. Well, we've gotten a lot of questions on that one, though. That's good. Yes, ma'am. We'll try to get to all of them. Right. The question is, when do you use azithromycin in treating these animals? And I don't have an answer for that because I have never used azithromycin. I pulled that from literature, and these are other drugs that are available. So I can't comment on something I have not personally actually used. So I really can't. I don't want to do that. Yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that's a good point. This is Rich Goldstein at Cornell. This young lady was talking to, and it's a really good point that I did not mention, is that now that we have this microalbuminuria assay that can detect early renal loss of protein, it might be a good idea to look at these patients. The only caution that I would have is that if you do a microalbuminuria test, make sure that this animal has a clean urine sediment, because you will get false positives and alert these people unnecessarily. Because I think that that's not a good finding when you find that in there to with them. So we're recommending that to do the C6 peptide quantitative analysis, check the titers on these patients, and see what the level is. If it's above a certain point, treat. Yes, question? Right. The question was in people, and we've done this with animals as well. There's no work done with it, but in people, if you get exposed to tick bites, sometimes they will. If you're in an area, put them on doxycycline. And we have done that with dogs when they've had heavy tick burdens. The last example of this was one of our faculty members took their dogs to a campground and just got loaded with ticks and just with having a fit, you know, because the numbers of ticks that she came back with on her dogs, and we put them on there. And we believe that the earlier, and this is from work that's been done, the earlier that you treat these animals, the better off you are. And so now, does every dog who gets a tick deserve a course of doxy? I don't think so. But when they have a huge tick burden, I couldn't argue that that's not a reasonable plan to put them on doxycycline. Yes? Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, because we work with tick transmitted diseases, we get that question all the time, and people are confused. Why would you even put this on a heartworm test? And I think that the reason is that just like heartworm disease, subclinical infections occur with these animals. And the difference, though, is that if you have an animal that's heartworm positive and you don't treat them and don't put them on preventative, the likelihood is that as time goes on, they're going to get sick. Whereas these, we don't know how many are going to get sick, and that's the difference. But the reason is that we, just like heartworms, these animals get infected and they carry the bug. And some of them break with chronic disease. It's the best answer I can give you. And that's why they tested for routinely. Yes, sir.
I'll get to you. The value of the C6 test when you get a 3DX positive for Lyme disease.
The value. The quantitative analysis?
Right.
Yeah. I have not done any work with the quantitative assay. But my understanding of it is that if an animal has, the C6 actually gives you what's equivalent to an antibody level, a titer is what it gives you. And my understanding is that within 3 months after clearing infection, that C6 peptide drops down, the antibodies to it. So you can measure a response to treatment with that. With regard to therapy, with regard to the level of antibodies to the C6 peptide and the occurrence of clinical disease in these animals, I don't know that we have those answers yet. Yes, sir?
They're talking about treating these animals prophylactically, just need antibiotics to take care of the infection.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. You know, if you're treating them right when they become inoculated with the heavy tick burden and not when they've developed chronic or disease associated with the infection or a chronic infection, does it really require 4 weeks of therapy? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. Yes, in the back? Right. Right. In my opinion, I don't think so, because you never know how, you never know what that antibody titer did after your treatment. It could still be positive because it's really just a, it's really not a quantitative test at all. It could still be positive when in fact the animal's antibody titers have dropped significantly from what it was. So no. You'd have to do the quantitative analysis, yeah, and retest in 3 to 6 months. Yes, yes, sir. Right. And you deal with a lot of it. And are you seeing change? You're seeing that you...
Sure, you'll see a drop.
Okay. Yeah. And to me, when I see an antibody level that's one level, and then a treatment that causes a reduction, and then to me, that treatment was effective in doing something. Did it completely clear the bug? I don't know that you can say that. Yeah. But right, right. Yes, in the back.
What are your recommendations as far as vaccinating for Lyme,
if an animal comes back positive and has been treated for Lyme, be it that they've never been vaccinated before, or if they have been vaccinated before and then come up positive for Lyme and are treated, do you recommend that they still be vaccinated? Yeah, you know, I will tell you that where we are located in the center of Florida, we do not see enough Lyme disease to vaccinate. So I don't personally vaccinate for Lyme disease. In speaking with people in areas like you all, many of you all are from, that have lots of Lyme disease, the recommendations that I'm hearing from the people who work with the tick-borne diseases is that they treat and they vaccinate positive animals. Do they revaccinate after an animal was vaccinated once and still became positive? I don't know the answer to that. I've never actually asked them that question. But from the people that I've just talked to, they believe that, and this is empirical, nobody really knows for sure what we're doing and how effective we are in preventing disease. But they're treating and they're vaccinating. Yes, sir. Right, and what that does to the immune system to the current infection, who knows? I don't know, but absolutely you would prevent reinfection, and it seems like the vaccines are very good. Okay, maybe we better go on to Bartonella, because I think that when does this session end? Yes. You're gonna tell me before. Okay. Okay, let me. 425. Okay, we're doing good. We may not get to our little case, but at least we'll get to Bartonellosis, which I want to talk about. Okay, so let me kind of bring you up to date a little bit on what we know about canine Bartonellosis and how it relates to these other tick-transmitted diseases. This is not a new organism. It was actually discovered a long time ago in Peru, and it originally was recognized as a parasite that invades red blood cells in humans. It was later renamed Bartonella bacilliformis, which is the name most of us are familiar with for the type species for the genus Bartonella. Then in 93, when we first recognized the cat scratch fever organism, it was actually placed in this genus, Roslamea, but then they combined these genuses to the Bartonella genus, and then had since that time recognized several species of Bartonella that infects humans, cats, and dogs, over 20 now. The ones that we're most concerned with, as best we can tell, in dogs are the Vinsonii subspecies Burkhoffi and Hensley. There have been reports of other Bartonellas in dogs, but the vast majority of the work that we've seen so far with canine Bartonellosis have involved these two organisms here. Okay, so we'll talk mostly about them and what is known about this little bug. This is a case that we had in a hospital. This animal had an acute endocarditis. and a hemolytic anemia. We actually, this is an older case, we actually found the organism in this one, but it's the only time that I've ever seen it. In humans, when they get the infection with other species of Bartonella, they can often find the organisms, but here it's difficult in animals to ever see the bug. But it is a gram-negative rod. It invades erythrocytes and endothelial cells. And I think that's important that for us to recognize that those are the two cell types that invades with regard to what kind of diseases these things can cause. Just like our other organisms, they cause persistent, long-term infection and long-term bacteremia that can be cultured from these people and animals once they get infected. It is vector transmitted for the most part, and there have been several vectors documented to carry these bugs and suspected to be able to transmit it. Most of the biting insects are able to transmit this little rascal. In human medicine, they're very concerned about the various ways that people get exposed to this organism, also very concerned about inability to get rid of infection. They will admit that, at least for this bug in humans. So if we look at the two main studies that were done of seroprevalence of Bartonella infection, this was done by Ed Brightsworth, and actually was published a few years ago in AHA Journal. Looked at seroprevalence of Vinsonii subspecies Burkhoffii and found that it ranged from 3.6 to 36% seropositivity, which would indicate either previous exposure and still antibody levels or chronic infection. The interesting thing with this bug, just like the other ones, is that animals that were treated all converted, of the ones that he followed in a different study, all converted, in the same study, all converted to a negative status once they were treated properly for this organism. Again, illustrating that what does positive titer mean? Yeah, it certainly could just mean previous exposure, but we know that these animals get chronically infected with these bugs, and that if they're cleared, as best we know, the titers disappear. Okay, so again, we find the same scenario. In a different study, looking at a different Bartonella henselae in the southeastern United States, 10% prevalence in healthy dogs, 26% in sick dogs. And so what both of these studies actually showed was that in a healthy population of animals, when you tested them, the prevalence was fairly low, but that if you had certain criteria, you would see a high prevalence. Of course, tick exposure being one of the prime criteria. People in rural areas, and for some reason, the animals that had association or contact with cattle had a higher seroprevalence with this disease. And animals that are positive for other tick-borne agents have a higher seroprevalence of Bartonella infection as well. And again, all of these can result in subclinical disease. What about transmission in the canine? I think the important thing here is that it's been isolated from a number of different vectors that they could potentially transmit the disease. And we know that because of the co-infection with other tick-transmitted agents, that tick exposure is one of the prime mechanisms. One of the issues that we're dealing with today, though, is blood transfusion. Certainly, it's been documented in literature with humans, experimentally transmitted with just infected blood in cats. And whether or not this happens when we transfuse animals with blood, we don't know, but we suspect that it could. And it's just something else we have to worry about when we're talking about banking blood and what are we testing these animals with before we start using blood that for transfusion. What are we testing these blood donors for in the process of collecting blood from them? So it's a problem that we may have to be facing here in the future. So what's some factors associated with developing clinical disease? Well, it's just like all of the other diseases that we associated with, but I think it's got a little bit different twist with Bartonella that we'll talk about. We know that chronic infections are well tolerated in animals, and they can be symptomatic carriers. In another study, Ed Brightsworth followed. He's done a lot of the work with Bartonella infection, and he followed dogs for 18 months, a group of animals that he knew were Bartonella positive that he identified without treating them because they were clinically healthy, and was able to culture organisms out of these dogs 8 out of 10 times that he tried culturing it over an 18-month period. So we know that these chronic infections can occur and that organisms circulate and they're viable in these animals, even though they weren't sick. And then something can happen to them and cause clinical disease. And we know for certain that they can play a role in the development of other tick-transmitted diseases. And one of the interesting things about Bartonella infection is that it's immunosuppressive. That this is one of the organisms that's been shown experimentally to cause immune suppression by impaired phagocyte function of monocytes, reduction in circulating CD8 lymphocytes, and increase in CD4 lymphocytes. So we know that all of evaluation of immune stimulation and immune suppression that's been done with these organisms indicates that it can suppress the immune system. And if it does that, certainly making animals more susceptible to other agents they might have been infected with in the process of being exposed to these ticks, as well as Bartonella itself. The question is Bartonella intracellular? And it does live intracellularly. That's in the erythrocytes and in the endothelial cells.
So that being the case, CD8 is more important than
CD4, isn't it? Yes. Yes. Absolutely, because it is an intracellular organism. CD8 response would be important in eliminating the infection. Okay, so what about clinical signs of Bartonellosis? Boy, and they can be, they again can be varied. Joe Tabota and I did a session last night, and he had some cases that he presented, and one of them was a dog he had suspected had Bartonellosis. And this animal actually presented with endocarditis and a hemolytic anemia and protein losing glomerular nephropathy. So it had the whole gamut of things that can happen with these animals. But it can be extremely variable. Many animals can be asymptomatic, and certainly if they develop endocarditis, they can die of sudden death with these infectious diseases. If they do develop endocarditis, you know, they got a systemic disease that can shed bacteria and immune complexes, and they can develop joint pain, thromboembolic disease, glomerulonephritis, a neurological disease, a number of different things can manifest. And this can be a very difficult finding on these animals. To diagnose endocarditis in a patient. One of the things that we've seen with Bartonella infection is granulomatous disease. These animals will get lymphadenopathy, and you'll aspirate the node, and I'll show you some pictures of them, or they'll get nodule in the spleen, large nodule, and you aspirate it, and it's full of macrophages, as well as the lymphoid population in there. And we can do IFA testing, test them and treat these animals, and they go away. So granulomatous disease is another thing that we see in these patients. Less frequently, they can get a cutaneous vasculitis, because remember, it infects endothelial cells, or uveitis. Epistaxis is something else that they can present with. And this is a real controversial issue about immune-mediated hemolytic anemias and thrombocytopenias and what role they might be playing. Bartonella might be playing with this. This particular dog that Joe Tabota presented with actually had an immune-mediated anemia that he suspected was Bartonella-induced. And in people especially, hepatitis, but it's only rarely been reported in dogs. So this is an aspirate from a lymph node of an animal that had IFA positive for Bartonellosis and responded to the azithromycin therapy. And what we're looking at here, and the reason why I'm showing this, is that, you know, if you look at this, even if you trained at looking at nodes and you see these lymphocytes, say, okay, this is a node, and look at these huge cells that look really bizarre, you would wonder whether this animal had a tumor involving this node. Particularly, I'm talking about a histiocytic tumor like malignant histiocytosis involving this node. And this totally responded to azithromycin therapy. So you need to be aware of it. And one of the things that triggers me to considering that is the presence of these neutrophils along with the histiocytic population. And usually don't see that with tumors. But, you know, it can be very challenging to interpret. This happened to be from a splenic nodule from a dog. And again, here are these big histiocytic cells that are in this animal's spleen. And this animal totally responded to azithromycin therapy. But again, you see these in the spleen, and one of our differentials is tumor. So what about laboratory findings? What are some reported laboratory findings? And I compiled these from the two reports that were most comprehensive, looking at laboratory findings associated with Bartonella infection. Again, these animals, thrombocytopenia and neutrophilia are the most common findings of clinical Bartonellosis, not subclinical, but clinical Bartonellosis. About a third of them are anemic, while and about half are non-regenerative anemias, but many of them have regenerative hemolytic anemias. And of the animals that were tested with hemolytic anemias, three of the four that were tested were Coombs positive. But that's not uncommon, for hemoparasites to induce a Coombs positive hemolytic anemia. That is not an uncommon finding. It happens with Babesia. It happens with Mycoplasma in cats. So it's not an unusual thing. The question is that you don't see these bugs. You won't find these organisms in the peripheral blood. So which animals are Bartonellosis induced and which are not? And that's something that we just have to deal with to try to find it out. So, and interestingly, some of them had eosinophilia as well and liver enzyme elevations. So a little bit of a challenge to work with these organisms. Polyarthritis, again, with immune complex disease, with these systemic infections, these are common things that happen. And again, you will find non-degenerate neutrophils in the joint, but you can't find the bug. Okay, you won't find the organism. Just something else we need to think about in animals that present with polyarthritis. So can you look at the organism? Yes, you can. You can find the bug. If you have an animal and you get them very acutely within the first 2 weeks of this nodule popping up, causing a lesion somewhere, and you biopsy it, and you ask them to use this Warthin-Starry stain, you can see it. So it's a if and a if and a if, but it's possible. And you can PCR amplify the bugs out of tissues, but it's best if you get them within the first 2 weeks of development of lesion and before you put them on antimicrobials, because that really knocks your chances of finding the organism either way down considerably. Okay, so that's one way to look at it. Most labs do serodiagnosis, and there is IFA tests available to diagnose Bartonellosis. And this is just an example of one here. And again, like most IFAs, we look for a titer of 1 to 64 or higher to indicate previous exposure or current infection. The interesting thing is that from the work that's been done so far, cross-reactivity between Vinsonii and Henselae is not predictable. So if you really want to test an animal, they need to be done simultaneously. You have to do both of these. And I don't know that it would rule out the possibility of one of the other infections like Chlorisiae. We don't know about the cross-reactivity. This has actually been reported that the cross-reactivity between these organisms on IFA is not likely. It's unusual, but it happens. So we actually need to check for that. And again, on animals that are positive, I keep bringing this up, but you have to also consider the potential for co-infection with these bugs. Now let's talk a little bit about treatment. We might even be able to get to our little case. Antibiotic of choice and duration of therapy has truly not been worked out experimentally. These are the drugs that have been used. The top two most frequently, people working with this organism, particularly Ed Brightsworth, will tell you he thinks that you can float these organisms in doxycycline and they will not respond. What everyone agrees on is that prolonged therapy is required. And as I mentioned before, in human medicine, at this Rickettsial meeting, there was a lot of concern that you could not clear people with Bartonellosis. And I gave a lecture last week, and I talked to a young lady whose boyfriend, her fiancé, caught Bartonellosis from a cat scratch. developed a lymphadenopathy, and now a year and a half later, although they treated him with azithromycin, she said they didn't treat him for as long as what we're talking about here, but he's still sick and weak from that infection. That he bleeds from infection. He's been through, you know, the routine, we're going to run you through this test, run you through that test, run you through this test, so it's a problem. Doxycycline would not try. And that's the problem that we deal with doxycycline, is that we use it for all these other tick-borne diseases. So you have an animal that's not responding to doxycycline. It is a worthwhile to test that animal for Bartonellosis if you're treating it for another tick-borne disease and it's not responding to doxy. Or it responds to doxy, but when you take it off, the animal relapses again. Okay? Azithromycin is a treatment of choice for this disease. And this is the current recommended therapy. 5 to 10 milligrams, you know, the magic dose, once a day for 24, for 5 to 7 days. So for the first week, once a day, and then every other day for 5 more weeks at the same dose. So that's a 6-week course in therapy that's currently recommended. And in speaking with Adam Birkenauer over at North Carolina State, he says that sometimes in some animals they've been adding rifampin to this protocol. I don't know the dose that they're using, and so if you had questions, I would contact them. If you had an animal you felt needed more than just azithromycin. But it's a tough little rascal to kill. So what do we know about Bartonella and co-infection? Well, this is what's in the literature. With regard to Ehrlichia canis infection, if you look in the literature and talk about Ehrlichia canis experimental inoculation, you won't find it causing epistaxis. And it is believed that if you have an E. canis positive animal and he presents with epistaxis, because of the vasculitis associated with Bartonella, these animals are co-infected. So that's one of the things that we look for in patients, is that one is E. canis infection, two, he's got epistaxis, which we have never actually demonstrated with Ehrlichia positive animals in experimental infection. The epistaxis associated with Bartonella infection isn't just associated with thrombocytopenia. In fact, it might not be thrombocytopenic and still bleed from the nose, and it's because of the vasculitis and invasion of endothelial cells that this organism does that causes the nose bleeding. And again, non-responders is something else we would want to consider. What about anaplasma and Bartonella? Well, this work, again, was just recently presented in Internal Medicine and presented in an abstract in this study that looked at dogs in the Northeast that were Bartonella positive. So they had a group of dogs that were Bartonella positive and started testing them for other tick-borne diseases. And this is what they found, is that the 25% of dogs that were Bartonella positive were also anaplasma positive. So I think, again, it's enough for us to be concerned and to consider with these patients. Bartonella, but not anaplasma, is associated with peripheral lymphadenopathy. So in these cases that he looked at, only dogs with Bartonella had lymphadenopathy. If they had anaplasma alone and not Bartonella, they did not. So it's another indication that, well, if I have an animal that's got anaplasma but has a peripheral generalized lymphadenopathy, maybe you need to check these animals for Bartonella as well. And I will tell you that the last couple of cases, and it's only because we've been checking, I don't know how many before that, of anaplasma platus that we've had, generally it's considered to cause very mild disease that just clinically disappears in these patients. This is another anaplasma that infects platelets. But we've seen cases of clinical anaplasma platus infection, one of which, this last case, had been treated with doxycycline and relapsed. And we tested them, the last couple of cases, for Bartonella, and they were both positive and co-infected with Bartonella vinsonii. So, again, this is something that is real and something that is out there and we actually need to deal with. Okay, I don't know that... how much time do I have, Dr.? How many?
Minus 1 minute.
Okay, we have -1 minute. So, okay, then we better stop. No. I'll hang around and answer questions because people may have to get to another thingy and whateverness. Okay, thank you all.